Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to Seriously, the podcast from the New Statesman that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich. This week we're talking about the new Edgar Wright film Baby Driver and the Netflix feature film Okja.
We've also watched the BBC police drama Happy Valley for the first time, so we'll be talking about how that went later in the show.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously. Now, I'm lucky enough to have the wonderful Caroline sat opposite me, but there has been a change at Seriously Towers, hasn't there?
Yeah, so for people who follow me on Twitter avidly, this will not be new to you, but to everyone else in the world. I have left my full-time job at the New Statesman and I am now freelance, but do not worry because I will still be on Seriously and I will still be doing other podcasty things.
Yeah, but you're moving house, so there will be a change to Seriously.
There will be. So I currently live in London and as of August, I will live in Liverpool.
So sad.
So this podcast is about to become a long distance relationship.
I know. What are we going to do? I think it's going to be fine. I think we're going to gloss over it. I mean, the hole in my heart will never fully be healed, but hopefully you won't be able to tell listening at home that anything has changed.
No, we've done some tests and it sounds fine. Like, we're just, yeah. Technologically, we've got, you know, all the stuff. It's all good.
We have mics on our side.
We do. And yeah, I think it's going to be fine. And hopefully, fingers crossed, we will be a bit more regular with our release times. We'll be a bit less prone to having to cancel an episode if major news goes down that we have to work on the magazine for. So overall, it should be a good thing.
And people who know Liverpool, email Caroline your recommendations for cultural things in Liverpool.
Yeah, definitely.
So it was Seriously the 100th episode last week, which was so exciting. And everyone has been very positive about our Harry Potter special, our second Harry Potter special, in fact.
Which, incidentally, we had the best time doing.
Oh my God, it was so fun.
We got some great tweets from people being like, I can't believe that if you work at the New Statesman, you just get to hang out with your friends and talk about Harry Potter. I was like, yeah, that's my life. That's literally what we do.
That is my life.
We are that lucky.
And I just really loved doing that fan fiction bit. You missed out on that.
That was
great.
So good. If you haven't heard that or indeed any of it, you have to go back and find it.
So we've had some emails from listeners to the Harry Potter special. You've got one there, I see, Caroline.
So this is from Iona, who says, I loved your Harry Potter special Take Two so much. I'm a massive Harry Potter fan. I've got quite bad insomnia and listen to the audiobooks most nights to help me while away non-sleep time and stave off anxiety.
Don't we all? Oh yeah. My God, relate yeah. Hard.
And she says, I've met loads of other people who do the same. However, I've never really looked into the world of Harry Potter fanfic, and your podcast made me realise what a gaping hole this leaves in my life. Could you recommend some great fanfic to check out as a starting place?
This is a hard one, isn't it? We've had this question before on Seriously, and it's quite a difficult one to answer.
It is, because fanfiction is a very personal thing. So particularly with a universe like Harry Potter, which, I mean, it's... In terms of fanfiction, it's vast. There are like millions of stories out there in lots of different places. And depending on what you like, will depend on what you want to read. So I would say the best place to start is not with specific recommendations, but with websites you can go to find things. So the two I would recommend are Archive of Our Own, also known as AO3. and fanfiction.net. And both of those have quite good search tools, so you can search within the Harry Potter universe and filter it by, you know, I just want to read Harry Draco stories, or I just want to read
Marauder
stories, or I just want to read stories with Molly Weasley. And you can get quite specific as well. You can say, I want to read stories with roughly this rating, so either mature or PG-13, that are less than 5,000 words that involve Remus Lupin. You know, you can get really specific with what you want. And then once you've browsed that, you'll find some authors that you like. You might then go and explore their profiles and see what else they've written. And it'll all go from there. Like, as you say, it's a deep hole you can fall down. And I'm excited that you get to try this.
One recommendation, though, I would suggest, of course, that you start with Stephen Bush's work, which is almost canonical. In itself.
At this point, yes. And another place you can go, actually, I should say, is our friend Elizabeth Minkle, who we referenced her podcast, Fansplaining,
yes,
a couple of weeks ago. She also runs a newsletter called The Rec Centre.
It's very good.
Which is very good, which recommends lots of different fanfiction and fanfiction adjacent things.
And they've had several Harry Potter special ones, haven't they? So I'm sure they have an archive somewhere that you can look through, don't they?
Yeah, they do. So if you go on her Twitter, just search Elizabeth Minkle, you'll find the link to sign up for that.
We've had another email from Eleanor, who titles it wonderfully academically, The Problem with the Collective Female in Harry Potter. So Eleanor gets in touch to say that something that bothers her about the books is that we all know Rowling is a feminist, but this doesn't seem to extend to her presentation of girls plural in Harry Potter. Why is it that literally whenever there's a group of women, they're silly, hysterical, giggling or shrieking? For every Hermione and Ginny, there seem to be hordes of infantilized, derided extras. So she cites Cho Chang's friends, who are, quote, a group of the silliest girls Harry had ever encountered. I do remember that. And then all the middle-aged witches who are reduced to jelly by Gilderoy Lockhart. And she says, I'm not denying this behaviour exists, but I think Rowling chooses to highlight and exaggerate it more than necessary. Well, I've never even thought of that before. I've never really examined that trope. But now she says it's there. I do see it.
I agree. It's definitely there. And it's definitely less than ideal. When I was thinking about this, something I came up with is maybe Rowling is emphasising the fact that we're seeing the Wizarding World through the eyes of
A teenage boy.
Mm. So just as in the special, we were discussing the Harry Cho romance and all the problems with that, the fact that Harry sees Cho's friends as the silliest girls ever or whatever is just an extension of that. Ditto, he encounters the fans of Gilderoy Lockhart in the second book when he's like 12 or 13. I don't know. My theory only holds out if you see less of this, I think, as he grows up.
Yeah, and I think you do, I would guess. But also I think like there's a kind of weird, I don't get it, mystery surrounding like groups of women to Harry, because he never really seems to interact with big groups of women. And it's like, as you say, when he's talking to Hermione about Cho and he literally doesn't understand anything that's going through her mind, he just seems to not understand what could be funny about a Yule ball to a group of girls. And obviously it's funny, like it just is.
Yeah, I remember there's a conversation between him and Ron, isn't there, when they're both trying to ask people to the ball, and one of them says to the other, like, how do you get one on their own to ask them? They seem to move in packs.
Yeah, and I get what she's saying, that is kind of dehumanizing, but it's I also get it from Harry's perspective. But anyway, we could do a whole nother Harry Potter special at this point, and we should probably not.
Before the Harry Potter special, there was episode 99. And on episode 99, we discussed the Netflix series Glow.
I was like, in a big, big house, there was a dark, dark box.
Once upon a dark box.
There was... anyway, sorry.
And Joe writes in to say, I'm writing to thank you for your review of Glow. As a lifelong wrestling fan, I've discovered it's incredibly rare for the odd and wacky world of wrestling to ever be portrayed in a drama or comedy without making fun of it or insulting wrestling fans. Glow perfectly melds mainstream comedy and wrestling and is littered with Easter eggs for the hardcore wrestling fans. I'd highly recommend Max Landis's Wrestling Isn't Wrestling if you'd like to understand the appeal of wrestling a bit more and its melodramatic roots. It's a fun short watch and hopefully you'll get a few chuckles out of it. And he's put a link to it, which we will also tweet out from our Seriously Pod Twitter account if you want to see it.
Oh, what a great email. In other Seriously news, my God, isn't there a lot of it these days, Caroline?
We're an expanding media empire, what can we say?
Yeah, clearly. We have events coming up. They are all available to look at seriouslypod.com/events. But one in particular that we wanted to talk about is we're doing the Shout Out Festival in August.
Yes, and this is a really exciting event. So it's organised by the Shout Out Podcast Network, which is a podcast network for BAME podcasts. You know, it really celebrates diversity and promotes talent that maybe doesn't necessarily get a look in more traditional places. And they are running their very first festival. There's going to be two stages. We're going to be opening one stage.
We're going to be on early in the day.
We're going to be on early in the day.
I think it's 12:15.
And that's on the 5th of August at the Jeffreys Hall in London. So we would really, really like some support for this. This is going to be our first ever live episode. We've never done, you know, just sitting on a stage or indeed standing. Haven't even worked that out. Just, you know, doing what we do.
We could do like a Backstreet Boys key change where we like mostly sat down and then we just like, you raise me up and stand. That might be fun.
We might do that. We are also going to have some guests on stage with us. It's going to be really fun, but we are a bit scared that we might end up doing this to an empty room.
Oh, I think people will be there in their hordes, no?
Yeah. So anyway, please come along and support us for this. There is a special discount code you can get. So if you buy a ticket, you get a ticket for the whole day to see everything from us doing our amazing Backstreet Boys act to the incredible US podcast, Another Round.
Yes.
The gadget podcast, How to Kill an Hour. There's loads of different stuff going on.
I so want to go see Another Round.
Yeah, me too. So if you go to seriouslypod.com/shoutout, that'll take you straight to the ticket buying website. And I believe if you type in SRSLY and then the number 5 in the promo code box, you get some money off.
Wicked. So that sounds amazing. And we hope to see you there. I'll be there anyway. So
all of you. We'll see you all there,
yeah,
right?
Every single one of you. Yes. On with the show. That was, God, that we had a lot of life admin.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, lots of updates. But anyway, also we've watched some stuff this week.
So the first thing we're going to talk about this week is Baby Driver, which is the new film from director Edgar Wright, who you'll remember from things like Hot Fuzz and Scott Pilgrim versus the World. It stars Ansel Elgort, who you might remember as like the fit one from Fault in Our Stars, who also has a pop music career, as Baby, who is a getaway driver for bank robberies and other such heists and hijinks, who listens to music to soundtrack all of his exploits. So there's a lot of music in this film.
So you just starting your day or did you just get off?
They call, I go, you know.
So what is it you do?
I'm a driver.
Oh, like a chauffeur. Anyone I'd know?
I hope not.
What is your name?
Baby.
Your name's Baby. B-A-B-Y Baby.
Yeah, it's a love letter to music and listening to music, really.
Yeah. And I remember from my, whisper it, Mighty Boosh-obsessed teenage years, a music video that Edgar Wright directed starring Noel Fielding. It was called Blue Song by Mint Royale. And it is really very similar to that opening scene of Baby Driver. And Edgar Wright said he's wanted to make this movie for ages and ages, but when he was asked to do this music video and he was kind of short on ideas, he was like, oh, we'll like do this thing that I always imagined being the opening scene for this sort of music / getaway driving movie. And it really is so similar. So that's quite worth a Google if you want to just like check out, you know, how the idea is developed over time. But basically what you end up with is almost like a really, really long music video.
Yeah, essentially, because so much of it is soundtracked by what Baby is listening to. And we learn in the film that because he was in a car accident when he was young, he still has persistent tinnitus. And so part of the reason why he listens to music nonstop, iPod headphones in at all times, is to, you know, drown out his hearing problem. His foster dad is deaf and he communicates with him via sign language. So he, you know, hearing and listening are a very important thing to him.
Yeah, definitely. And so, yeah, this opening scene is literally him sat in the car waiting for some other people that he's on a job with to rob a bank. Is it a bank in the first?
I think it's a bank.
And then drive the car away. And you see him sort of press play on his like nice vintage classic iPod to a song. And then the whole scene is like choreographed very, very specifically to that song and the beats in the music. So, you know, you see people hitting other people to time with the beat. When the driving really kicks in after they all jump back in the car, everything that happens has a little nod to the music. And I feel like that's something you do see in other Edgar Wright films. Like, I think about Don't Stop Me Now bit in Shaun of the Dead, where they're all, like, hitting the zombie with, like, snooker cues in the pub. And Scott Pilgrim is very like that, isn't it?
God,
that first scene where he fights while he's at the front of the band.
Those three films that get called the Cornetto Trilogy, which is Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and World's End, all have something that I think is indelibly Edgar Wright, which is whenever anyone gets in a car, the sound of door slam, seatbelt fastened, engine start always happens to whatever background music is playing.
Absolutely.
And it's just particularly in Hot Fuzz, because they get in and out of the police car a lot. That it's almost a meme. It happens constantly. So, yeah, and I feel like Edgar Wright has now made an entire film that is that.
Yeah, and one thing that interests me about this is apparently this was not all done in post. This was something that they did on the shoot. They would, like, have the song playing. People would have, like, earphones in, synchronized earphones that were all playing the song at the same time. And the camera movements were all very, very deliberately coordinated, because apparently it's cheaper that way. But it also sounds so much more difficult. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to tell, but that it does pay off, because everything's so slick in those shots. And then I think my favorite scene maybe in the whole movie is actually not one that's in a car. I'm not that into cars. I enjoyed this film regardless. But when we have a long scene straight after that kind of opening heist where Baby goes to get coffee.
Yes.
And he's all he's doing is walking down the street, going to the coffee shop and walking back. But everything is so choreographed to the song he's listening to, which is Bob and Earl's Harlem Shuffle, which is that trumpet bit used at the beginning of Jump Around, like beep, 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 before the like song kicks in. So you kind of think that it's going to be that song and then it's a different song. But all the stuff that's going on, like, I don't know, someone presses a lift button or there's a woman getting her cash out of the ATM and it's like beep, 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 like to the tune of the song. When Baby's ordering his coffee, he's even saying like, yeah, 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 to like the yeah, yeah, yeahs in the song. And I think there's even like graffiti in the background and street signs that seem to be like copying the lyrics. And that for me was so like, oh my God, that's what my life feels like when I'm listening to music that I'm really into in my headphones. And I really like that he kind of ran with that fantasy, which is basically what he's doing throughout the whole movie. But that was my favourite exploration of it.
Yeah, it's a really clever way of giving you an inside perspective on the outside, right? Because it's trying to show you what Baby's world looks like. As someone who listens to music constantly, has headphones in at all times, he lives part in the world and part inside his iPod. Incidentally, I do want to just shout out to a friend of the podcast, Laura Snapes, who did a great tweet after she went to see this film, which said, amazing cameo by an iPod classic in the film.
Yeah, there's loads of really nice iPods in it. I like the one that he's got, like, he's got like a Diamante pink one. There's, I don't know, I feel like it's now such a thing that if you're a music lover, you have a proper iPod. Like, all the like people I know who write about music full time have proper iPods, and now I'm like, oh yeah, I should have one.
Even more so since Apple stopped making the proper iPod.
Exactly, the oldest classic, the proper iPod. One thing that I really like about this movie, which I think if you started interrogating it loads could probably fall down, I don't know, I feel like you could pick apart the fact that you can see kind of the mechanics of the film going on the surface, or you could pick apart the kind of racial politics or the gender politics, which I think are quite rubbish in this film.
Oh yeah.
If you look for it. But I think it was so fun and silly that I really didn't like want to do that. I was just like carried along by its rhythms and its movements so much that I didn't particularly care, that I was like, this is probably not that substantial a film beneath all the kind of like tricks and jumps and stuff.
No, it's not at all. But in that way, I thought it's the perfect summer movie, far more than any of the blockbusters that will get called that.
Definitely.
Because you've got some really great comedy performances from people like John Hamm, Jamie Foxx, Lily James, and it's that really clever kind of comedy that is both threatening, because all these people, with the exception of Lily James, play, you know, various criminals who are all a bigger or smaller danger to Baby and his eventual safety, but they're also very individual and very carefully painted, even though they maybe don't get that many lines or that much screen time, and also really funny.
Yeah. And it really made me think that one of the things that's so great about Edgar Wright is he does all of his movies, I feel like, are literally a boyish fantasy where it's been like, what if I was in this position? So like Shaun of the Dead, what if I, a normal bloke, was present at a zombie apocalypse? Hot Fuzz, like, what if I, a normal bloke who likes watching cop movies, was an actual cop in like a normal part of Britain?
Scott Pilgrim versus the world, even, you know, like, what if I could, like, do all this stuff that's in comics that I like to read? And this is like, what if I, music lover Edgar Wright, normal guy, was like a getaway driver, right? And so that's why I feel like I can't really hold that much against this, because I think it's quite knowingly silly and childish, but in a way that's just kind of like winking and delightful.
Yeah, and there's a really nice strain of cinematic nostalgia. There's lots and lots of references to Bonnie and Clyde and that kind of thing. It's also got a really strong strain of like Americana and the American dream. So like
diner scenes, my favorite stuff ever in movies.
So many diner scenes. Lily James's character works in a diner. And then also the kind of shared romance with her and Baby, where, you know, their biggest dream is just to like head west with a car they can't afford and a plan that they don't have.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very like, drive towards the sunset.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Serve the American dream, and those little fantasies that he has where, you know, she's waiting with an amazing car, wearing a lovely dress,
like a 50s,
yeah.
And it's the like moments where you're like, problematic, sweep it away, sweep it away.
Yeah. but you're right, you can see how, you know, problematic, yes, but as a boyish fantasy, probably real.
Yeah, and it's just really good fun.
Now we're going to talk about Okja, which is a new Netflix feature film from director Bong Joon-ho, with a screenplay by the director and John Ronson. It's all about a super pig called Okja, super pig being a new genetic strain of animal that's been created by the Mirando Corporation, headed up by Tilda Swinton as Lucy Mirando, a company which claims to be solving the world's food and farming and environmental problems by creating this new species. And the film focuses on the relationship between a young farm girl called Mija, who takes care of Okja and tries to protect her after it all goes south.
We needed a miracle. And then we got one. This beautiful and special little creature will be a revolution in the livestock industry. Our super pigs will not only be big and beautiful, they will also leave a minimal footprint on the environment, consume less feed, and produce less excretions. And most importantly, they need to taste fucking good.
So it's this funny combination, really, isn't it? Because we start off in this like kind of rural Korean, lovely, like children's idyllic movie where it's like young girl plays with lovely super pig saves her life. And, you know, it's just all the kind of tropes that you'd expect from like a Free Willy or a Babe or like those kinds of movies.
And it's so beautiful. So many lovely waterfalls and like beautiful. Super Pig is a bit like a giant hippo.
Yeah, I'd say hippo is the definitely the closest animal.
Lots of like nuzzling and splashing in water.
Oh, it's so lovely. And I love it when they like spoon. Mm. It's like bedtime and then you just see Media like creep into Okja's like big hoof. And then basically Jake Gyllenhaal turns up, doesn't he?
Yeah.
As this kind of slightly deranged celebrity animal person.
Yeah, kind of like
he's like a doctor or a vet.
Yeah, I think a vet, but I'm not sure.
He's kind of like a Steve Irwin style figure, right? And then he sort of comes in with this absolutely bizarre performance, but maybe we'll get to that later. And it's because Mija has been looking after Okja for 10 years and it's now time for the Super Pig to go back to the Miranda Corporation headquarters in New York and enter a competition. And the aim is that they'll use these 10 Super Pigs that they gave to loads of different farmers in different areas of the globe to kind of show off how beautiful their Super Pig creation is, even if it's not very representative of, you know, the majority of the Super Pig farming going on. So then Okja gets taken away from Mija. And Mija starts trying to get her back. And that's the tension of the film. And that's when it becomes, for me, a totally different genre and kind of film.
Yeah, then it becomes almost a sort of heist film with a strong strain of activism and like underground resistance.
Yeah, it's like satirical almost. It becomes like a jab at, I would say, like corporations that use kind of like ethical cloaks to kind of sell themselves and hide what they're really up to.
Yes, definitely, because what Lucy Mirando claims she's doing is, you know, solving world hunger with incredibly cruel and unhumane farming.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the bit that gets me, because there's another strain in this, which is just like very, very anti-GM food, right?
Yes.
So it's kind of like simultaneously against like the meat industrial complex that's so, you know, obviously terrible in its treatment of animals. I'm a vegetarian, just disclaimer, but it is grim. It seems like the director's very critical of GM food in general, which I'm a bit more like, I don't know that much about this, and I don't know if I think it's that bad, but I will probably have to do some research and find that out. But I thought that those bits were the strongest bits, even if they were the least like the kind of cuddly kids movie I thought I was meant to be watching, because some of the lines, the dialogue I found really funny in the kind of like Mirando headquarters when they're at like crisis point and they're trying to manage the situation, which is basically that Okja is captured by Mija and a group of like vigilante vegetarian activists who are like anti the super pig industry, and they like capture her while she's in transport and set her loose in a big Korean underground shopping mall, and it's like all over all the news and it's really embarrassing for the Mirando Corporation. So then they have to try and like manage that situation, and I found those scenes just incredibly funny.
Yeah, when they're doing like corporate speak about a giant hippo.
I don't know, there are some really clever bits, like when you watch them all watching the news footage of Okja like running around this mall in Seoul, the shot is exactly like the Osama bin Laden capturing photo, what's
standing.
It called, Situation Room, or where they're like all gathered around the screens. They're all doing the exact same expressions, you know, they've positioned people quite cleverly. And then it goes on to, you know, Lucy just raging about what a great job she's done. I love the bits where she's like, Slate said that these were the cutest pigs ever, but that they still wanted to eat them. These are journalists that never write about pigs. They never write about pigs. And it was just literally making me cry with laughter. So I thought that was really successful parts of the movie.
I thought Tilda Swinton was really good in this.
Oh, she's always great.
She's always great. And yeah, her kind of deranged, evil corporate monomaniac is really excellent. Should we come back to Jake Gyllenhaal?
I feel like maybe thought he was in a different film, because I quite like that first scene where he comes to Mija's home in rural Korea and like has climbed up an absolutely massive mountain and is completely sweaty and tired and a bit manic, and you know, filming one second and like hugging the girl another second and just all over the place. But then it becomes darker and darker as he's revealed to be like a potentially violent alcoholic, and then those scenes are just like way wilder than I was expecting, and I was a bit like, someone surely should have been like, tone it down, Jake. But it's obviously what they wanted, I guess.
Yeah, that you're right. And actually that highlights something that I found generally about this film, which is that it pulls in different directions. It has, it's a fusion of genres, and I'm not sure that that always works out.
Yeah, I think that's meant to be a trademark of the director's style, but having not really seen any of his other movies, I couldn't comment. But I know what you mean, and sometimes I was like, that's, I actually love this weird whiplash I'm getting, where I'm like, oh, look at the pig, lol, loving these jokes about Salon and Slate and whatever. But at other times, like the final 20 minutes are so gruesome when you actually make your way into the abattoir where these super pigs are being slaughtered. Suddenly you're like, whoa, I feel like I'm watching, you know, like a documentary on Netflix about why the meat industry is so terrible, and I wasn't really prepared for that going in.
Yeah, and you wrote a piece about this, about how this film fits into two of Netflix's preferred genres, both the sort of cuddly animal film and the, you know, exposing documentary about animal rights.
Yeah.
Things like Blackfish and so on.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, that was, after I'd watched it, I read your piece and I was like, this is, you're really spot on here, that if you were going to be uncharitable, you might say Netflix is like milking the numbers.
Milking the super pig.
Yeah.
The cash super pig. Yeah. I think there's two things that I realised about Netflix fairly recently, which is one, that they just have like a huge number of horse movies.
Yes.
If you like horses, you can find all the horse movies and TV shows you want on Netflix. And B, that like every kind of like self-professed educated person I know would be like, you have to watch this documentary on Netflix. Mm. And they've got a real thing in that too. So it was quite controversial that this film was going to be released on Netflix, because it premiered at Cannes, and Cannes have never had a, you know, a streaming service first movie at their festival. It was booed when it premiered at Cannes. I think A, because there was a technical problem, but B, because people were like, we don't like that, you know, we like supporting cinemas and films being released in cinemas. And I think Isabelle Huppert made the opening address at Cannes, and she was like, Netflix. And everyone was like, yeah, boo, boo, Netflix. So it's been pretty controversial, but I'm like, oh, it seems like the perfect place for this film is Netflix, because it does, you know, blend these trends. And not everyone can afford to go to the cinema all the time, and Netflix is cheap. And I also love going to the cinema, and I do want to support theatres, but sometimes it slips into snobbery for me, that debate.
I automatically just side with, you know, the side being booed in things like this. For me, it felt a lot like when, you know, Martin Freeman did Richard III, and theatre critics were all like, who are these people in the theatre who
too
like
many teens
who like him off Sherlock? How dare they clap when he comes on the stage? Boo, hiss.
That is one of your absolute pet hates.
That is one of my absolute pet hates. And yeah, kind of being like, Netflix, how dare you turn up, spend loads of money on movies, and then expect us to, you know, treat them critically as we would the ones that you can't see on your laptop. That just really riles me.
But yeah, I would actually recommend it, as long as you are prepared for what you're going in for. It's not like a horror movie. It's nothing too terrible, but if you're not expecting it, it can be a bit of a jump, right?
Yeah, it actually made me think about when I was at school, maybe 13, 14, and we watched a documentary about battery farming. Maybe in science. And by the end of the day, everyone in my class declared themselves to be a vegetarian, and a couple of people had had to go to the nurse's office having hysterics.
Yeah, no, not for me. I won't be watching
that. So it's not anywhere near as bad as that.
No.
But yeah, it does definitely make you think about these things, which is a good thing. While I'm far away from you, my baby, I know it's hard for you, my baby. Because it's hard for me, my baby, and the darkest hour is just before dawn.
So last week we agreed to watch Happy Valley after countless recommendations and just generally feeling so behind and out of the loop. So the first season of this BBC show is on Netflix in the UK. I don't know about the US, might be. And so we watched it there. Caroline, immediate thoughts?
My immediate thoughts are, why didn't I listen to everybody and watch this years ago?
I know. How much did you watch?
I watched all of the first episode and then about half of the second one, and only stopped reluctantly when I had to come here to do this.
Yeah, I watched two, and I'm like, need another. It's obviously just like a really suspenseful plot. So it's about Catherine, who is a police officer, and she's had a difficult life. She lives with her sister, who's a recovering heroin addict, and her grandson, because her daughter died. And that's kind of a situation that you hear more about as the first episode unfolds. And then there's this sort of mysterious guy who's been released from prison, and we know he's done something terrible that in Catherine's life, but we don't really know what exactly. And at the same time, there's this plot evolving about a man who's unhappy in his job, feeling very downtrodden, and needs more money, and his boss refuses to give it to him and makes the very ill-informed decision to maybe kidnap his boss's daughter or get other people to kidnap his boss's daughter.
Come through to my office and you can start at the beginning.
I'm Catherine, by the way. I'm 47. I'm divorced. I live with my sister, who's a recovering heroin addict. I've two grown-up children, one dead, one who don't speak to me, and a grandson.
Dark in Speed Bump City, where the only thing that's pretty is the thought of getting out.
It's a bit mad, isn't it? Date with your ex-husband.
You get too old for this, Catherine, love.
How would you like to make £500,000?
You're talking about kidnapping.
I've got to ring the police.
You left abruptly. Everything all right?
Yes. Yeah.
So there's a lot going on, but the threads do quite quickly all come together and you start to see a bigger picture forming. But it's just so suspenseful.
It's so suspenseful. It's so cleverly written, and the characters are so well drawn, particularly Catherine. Even in the first episode, you're like, I know you and I root for you and I want good things for you.
It's an amazing performance, isn't it?
Yeah, Sarah Lancashire actually won a BAFTA this year for it.
Good.
So it's written by Sally Wainwright, who also wrote Last Tango in Halifax and lots of other things, some of which Sarah Lancashire has been in. So they are a seasoned like writer-actor team. Yeah. So it's not that surprising maybe that it works so well.
Mm.
Also, we should say where it's set. It's set in Calderdale, in the Calder Valley in West Yorkshire.
Mm.
So you've got this backdrop of amazing hills and terraced houses and all this kind of thing. But also what Sally Wainwright does so well is she never falls into the sort of northern cliches, in that everyone you meet has an interesting individual story and no one's like a type.
Yeah. And it's interesting the way she kind of weaves social issues into the drama. It never feels too heavy, but you know, for example, that there are really big drug problems in that area and how that kind of feeds into the lives of so many characters, even if it's not directly, is really, really interesting. One thing I really like about the characterization, though, as you say, is that when she writes, she manages to make people do things and you just get a sense of their bigger character without anyone having to say, like, oh, him, he's a bit like this, isn't he? You know, there's very minimal exposition. But for example, the James Norton character, who is one of our favorite actors, misogyny just drips into everything he does.
Yeah.
And there's no point where he has to be like, oh, I just think women are sluts. Do you know what I mean? But you see it in absolutely everything. He lights a cigarette and you see it. And you're like, wow, I can't believe he managed to just like weave a bit of misogyny into that cigarette being lit. And sometimes it just never feels super heavy-handed. And I really like that about her writing. But one thing that's just so good about it as well is the way that the plot is structured. Sometimes when I watch things like this and the plot is so good, I'm like, oh, how did you do that? I just could never do that. The thing with this first episode is that you see all these bad decisions being made and things happen as a result that really give you that feeling of like, oh, why did you do that? Why did you do that? And it's so frustrating, but kind of also really satisfying.
Yeah, I think what Sally Wainwright is really good is giving events that feeling of inexorable motion.
Exactly.
A momentum all of their own. There's nothing that the characters or you, the viewer, can do to stop it. And I think that's something, and actually I've heard her say this, that it's a craft that she honed when she was a staff writer on Coronation Street. Because what is a soap plotline if not a kind of deus ex machina movement of characters towards, you know, tragic ends at all times, ongoing forever? It runs for decades.
Yes, that's so true. And it does feel like we haven't watched the end of the first season, but it does feel like there's just a terrible tragedy on the horizon.
So a problem I'm having with this is that I've actually seen isolated scenes from Happy Valley at a talk Sally Wainwright gave at BAFTA a couple of years ago.
Do not spoil me right now, Caroline.
No, well, the thing is, I don't know where they go or what they are, but they made such an impact on me that, like, 2 years later, I can remember all of these clips in vivid detail because she illustrated her talk with particular examples from her work. And, yeah, there's one really horrific scene that she showed there.
I don't want to know what it is.
And I'm like, I don't know when or how this fits in, or indeed if it's even in the first series, maybe it's in the second series, but I know it has to come in somewhere and I'm terrified.
Oh my God. Well, I literally am loving it and I feel like I just haven't got far enough through it to like do proper thoughts. So maybe we'll think about talking about Happy Valley again, which is something we've said quite a lot recently, but it is something we're keen on doing, is doing a revisit episode at some point.
Yeah, that's true actually. Maybe when we're on holiday in August, that would be a good idea. So this would be a good moment. If there is anything that we've talked about recently where you've watched all the way to the end and you're like, I really want them to know what they thought about the ending, this is the point at which to email us while we're planning that episode. So do that. So for next time, we're going to do something slightly different, which is that we are, after we finish recording this, off to see a play, which has been recommended by an avid Seriously listener who is actually part of the team for the play, which is how we come to be going. The play is the Royal Shakespeare Company's Queen Anne, starring Romola Garai, and it's all about the kind of the like late 17th century, 18th century court drama and the women at the court at the time.
I feel like this is the kind of thing that you know about. I don't know anything about this, but I'm quite excited to just go in with like an ignorant, empty shell of a brain and just have it filled by this performance.
Yeah, well, I'm quite excited about this because it's a period of history that doesn't really, we don't get taught it at school. Like, it's not like the Tudors. It's not really on the syllabus. And so as such, I feel like there are fewer historical novels and dramas based around it. Yeah. So yeah, I'm really excited that they've done this, and particularly that they've focused on the women involved, because although Queen Anne was like Queen of Britain for quite a long time, we never hear about her.
Never, literally never.
So yeah, we're going to see a play about her and we'll report back next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to make sure you never miss another episode? We're available in all the usual places you get podcasts, including Apple Podcast, where you could also leave us a review if you'd like.
We've got lots of events coming up this summer, including festivals, live episodes and quizzes. Find out more and buy tickets at seriouslypod.com/event.
We're available many other places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook and Tumblr. We're Seriously Pod on all of them.
We love getting your recommendations for things we should feature on the show, or just hearing your thoughts on what we've discussed. Get in touch on social media or email us on seriouslypod@gmail.com.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell your friends and family about the podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.